ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As horrific as the sudden jump in oil and gas prices has been, the bright side ought to be a sudden jump in the money flowing into the hands of the nations lucky enough to produce it. Australia exports more gas, more liquefied natural gas, than just about any nation on earth. We account for one-fifth of the gas exported globally. Yet what the government gets in tax from that gas, what it charges for the gas, isn't even beer money. The government is set to collect $2.7 billion from the excise on beer this year, only $1.5 billion from the petroleum resource rent tax on gas. And Australian customers can't always get that gas. Importers are planning to import some of it back. How on earth did it come to this? And what's the government planning to do about it in the budget due in 2 weeks and 5 days' time? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, someone paid to understand every twist and turn in the story of Australian gas as the budget approaches, senior energy analyst at MST Financial, Sol Kavanik. And Ben Potter, contributing editor at The Energy, who's been on this story for the past decade. It's been unfolding at the Australian Financial Review. Welcome back, Ben, and welcome back, Sol.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be here again.
Pleasure as always, Peter.
Sol, how did it come to this? Can we look at Eastern States gas? It used to be plentiful, really plentiful, and cheap, especially in Victoria. Did Esso and BHP, who collected it as a byproduct of their search for oil, essentially give it away?
That's right. We had gas available for basically close to nothing for a very long period of time. And now that supply of gas is falling, and so there's less gas available. So that's one piece of the puzzle. The other two pieces come down to the LNG export industry, which was approved early last decade in Queensland. And in particular, one of the three projects there was built without enough gas of its own to keep its export contracts full. And so it actually took some gas from other domestic fields in Australia, particularly in the Cooper Basin, which otherwise would have been made available to the domestic market. And just the third piece to round it out is, over the last decade, the environment for approving gas projects has become a lot more hostile. So a lot of gas supply that industry thought would be developed hasn't. And these three things together have changed the dynamics of our market.
So the gas from the Cooper Basin that flowed to New South Wales and South Australia, the gas from the Bass Strait that flowed initially only to Victoria, got sucked up into Queensland to make LNG for export from one of these three very big LNG compression export facilities.
Gas supply from the Cooper Basin that would have normally gone to the domestic market was instead taken to the Santos GLNG project for export.
Ben, were there assurances given at the time that this wouldn't happen? In other words, that the Queensland export facilities, the massive expensive facilities approved by the Gillard and Rudd governments, would have their own gas and that it wouldn't much affect the gas the rest of Australia used?
Peter, I think that was the understanding. I'm not sure if it was explicit or legally undertaken, but I think that was the understanding. And there were certainly warnings that if the exporters, Saul's mentioned the Santos-led GLNG consortium in particular, had contracted for exports more gas than their fields delivered, that they would have to draw on gas that traditionally went to the domestic market, and domestic customers could be squeezed. But I think these warnings were dismissed by both the industry and I think the federal government because of this huge sense of excitement at the massive investments that were being made in the LNG export terminals in Gladstone. I think $160, $180 billion was the figure bandied about at the time, and I think that's increased above $200 billion. So it's, yeah, one of those situations where some people warn about it, but there's too much momentum behind the industry and the investments.
Was there a push at the time, Saul, and I don't remember it, and I was reporting on this, these new gas plants at the time, was there a serious push to do in the east of Australia what Western Australia does, which is to reserve, it's called gas reservation, reserve gas equivalent to 15% of what the Northwest Shelf produces for use in Western Australia, which has resulted in fairly cheap gas in Western Australia. Was there a push to do that for these big projects starting in Queensland and taking up gas from the East Coast?
That was a discussion at the time. So, in disclosure, I used to work in the LNG industry back then on the West Coast. And I must say, many in the LNG industry itself have predicted everything that has played out on the East Coast. And we were actually gobsmacked that all three of these LNG projects went ahead, in particular the Santos GLNG one, without enough gas to meet its requirements, which is very unusual in the industry. My understanding from speaking to folks who were in the industry back then is that there were representations made that this wouldn't impact domestic prices. But at the same time, part of the business case internally for doing the GLNG project was it would increase domestic prices, right? And so it wasn't just about when that project went ahead and it took the gas from the Cooper Basin out for export. There's three projects, right? So two of the other projects actually supply net volumes into the domestic market. So they actually do similar to what the West Coast reservation policy is. And back then, the Shell project sold a large long-term contract of cheap gas to AGL. So it did its bit to provide cheap gas to the domestic market. And what happened? AGL turned around, sold all that cheap gas that should have gone to domestic customers to the GLNG project for export. And you can just imagine not only what this has done to our domestic market, but imagine if you are one of the LNG projects who's doing the right thing, and then you're just seeing that your neighbour is taking all the profit away from you as a result, and you're not helping the domestic market anymore. Like, this was all the kind of shenanigans that went on over the last decade.
What happened to gas prices, Ben, and gas availability within years of these plants opening?
Prices, they doubled, then they tripled, and contracts became harder to get for domestic manufacturers at what they regarded as affordable prices.
This would have been really bad for Victorian manufacturers in particular because they were set up to use gas, it being so cheap. I think two-thirds of the gas used in Australia was used in that one state, Victoria. We had big companies set up to use gas.
Well, precisely. And there are some notable companies that went to the wall as a result. Coogee operated a methanol plant in Laverton. Dow had a chemical plant, I think, in Altona. And a brickmaker, a traditional, I think, 100 years plus old brickmaker in Queensland called Claypave. They all went out of business or closed plants because of the huge increase in the price of domestically available gas.
So now, after the event, both the Coalition and Labor are promising some form of gas reservation rule, and at various times they're threatening the industry with it. Is this sort of too late, given that they've got long-term supply contracts with Japan, some of them 25 years?
Well, it's much, much harder to come and impose a reservation now after everything has been built than if it had been done beforehand. So West Australia is a good example where the reservation policy was put in place beforehand. It was negotiated with each project. On the East Coast, the reason this becomes very complicated is, as you say, there's now contractual commitments that have been put in place. But it's also just about the integrated way our gas market works. And a lot of these projects haven't been set up to just rapidly provide a whole bunch more gas to the domestic market. And so you put these things together, and while it's not impossible, it's just the trade-offs involved imposing a reservation now are going to be a lot higher. It was all under the Rudd-Gillard government at the time, where, you know, politicians not only just approved this without having a reservation, when I think a reservation could have been imposed then without stopping at least most of the projects going ahead. But even back then, for example, the ACCC was making it difficult for the projects to get together. So as a result, we got an overbuild of projects.
They wanted to protect overseas customers. They didn't want collusion.
And I cannot understand why that was. You know, the ACCC is supposed to be protecting Aussie consumers, not foreign consumers.
Ben, the Prime Minister is telling Australia's gas customers overseas, is going overseas, is saying we are a reliable supplier and using this as sort of leverage to shore up supplies of oil for Australia. The government has announced that it will introduce a reservation policy. Does that make it sort of more difficult?
Oh, well, look, undoubtedly, Peter, we're in a very strange time of crisis at the moment with the supply of liquid fuels to Australia. But I think, you know, it's open to the Prime Minister to say, tell our export customers that circumstances have changed. And the government did make it at least nominally commit itself to reservation in December, nominating a range of 15 to 20% of the value of production. Details to be announced, the fingerprints of the industry minister, Tim Ayres, who's probably a little more interventionist than some of the other ministers in the cabinet, were on that. I think the government probably needs one or the other, reservation or some increase in taxation, to keep faith with local customers. But it's also faced a very tricky balancing act to both keep the export customers happy and to treat the three LNG exporters who have different records in this over the last decade fairly.
So the industry doesn't much mind one form of reservation, which is just you can get 15% of the gas at the large foreign prices. Do we have any idea what kind of gas reservation program we're likely to get?
The industry itself doesn't even have a unified view on this. So we're actually at the point now where most of the gas industry is willing to support at least a prospective reservation, so for new fields. And we're really actually seeing, so again, those two other LNG projects, the Shell QCLNG and Origin's APLNG, seem to be supportive of even imposing a retrospective reservation, but provided it's done where it kind of impacts all three of them equally. But of course, the third project looks at that very differently, because that therefore almost entirely impacts them and could potentially impact their export contracts to their customers. And so the industry doesn't have a unified view. And then on the policy side, key details about what the federal Labor government's working on here is unclear. And a lot of that detail has to do with, do they want to impact the Santos GLNG project, even if that risks some of the export volumes to its customers and the contracts? Because the government said it's committed to maintaining the sanctity of contracts. Or are they going to actually have a reservation more similar to what the Dutton opposition opposed in the last election, which was more about restricting uncontracted volumes and forcing those into the domestic market, which impacts the Shell project and the Origin project rather than the Santos project?
Into this mess, Ben, comes a plan, four plans actually. One of them, they've actually built the import terminal to import LNG, some of which would come from Australia. That is to say, it'd be put on ships at Gladstone in Queensland and then imported at Port Kembla in New South Wales with enough capacity to meet nearly all of New South Wales' needs. Am I alone here in thinking this is a bit odd, that the world's biggest gas exporter importing gas, some of it gas it's prepared to put on ships?
Well, you're certainly not alone, Peter, because the optics of that are extremely odd. When these plans were formulated, the proponents were all arguing that because there was a coming global oversupply in the LNG market, they could regasify and supply LNG as gas into the domestic market at a competitive price. That has kind of blown up with the conflict in Iran and the impact of that on exports of LNG through the Straits of Hormuz. But even before that, the customers had seen these proponents coming and were not signing contracts. So it was kind of a case of all dressed up with no customers. And Squadron Energy actually sublet its floating storage and regasification unit, which is basically a ship that turns, you know, frozen LNG into gas molecules for consumption, to an Egyptian company called EGAS. And they now can't retrieve that floating facility until 2027. But now that the Iran war has happened and the resolution of the Straits of Hormuz impasse, you know, doesn't look clear at the moment, there may be no LNG oversupply anyway, and therefore the prices may be against the LNG importers.
So as far as, shall we say, a system where things go wrong, gas seems to be right up there. How do you see the supply playing out?
Look, unfortunately, I think things are still likely to get worse. We're going to see a massive reduction in supply in offshore Victoria, which is really going to put pressure on the market at the same time as we're seeing an increase in demand for gas capacity in our power system due to the increase in renewables, which requires bigger peaks of gas supply to balance things out. And while there's an opportunity here with the reservation policy to finally put an end to all the constant policy changes and put something in place, which I think could work, I do fear that as we go through the details of this, they're not necessarily going to get it right. And we actually just end up with another kind of half-baked policy, which doesn't achieve the outcomes and all the uncertainty remains. And if that's the way things go, we're just looking at continued increased volatility and ultimately higher prices. And that's not actually something that any stakeholder wants here. And yet it seems to be the path we continue to head down.
And we're not getting that much money for the high-priced gas, which is what we're about to discuss here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, our guests Sol Kavanagh, Senior Energy Analyst at MST Financial, and Ben Potter, Contributing Editor with The Energy. So, those figures I quoted earlier, that we earn less from the PRRT, the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax on gas, than we do from the tax on beer, they come from a Senate hearing in February when Senator David Pocock asked Treasury official Shane Johnson what the MIEFO budget update estimates were for the revenue from each.
Would it be accurate to say that the tax on offshore gas exports, PRT, is still giving us less revenue than the tax on beer?
Have a look. Just bear with me a second. In 25-26 in my info, taxes on beer, we're expecting $2.7 billion. Taxes from PRRT, $1.5 billion, so yes, lower than.
How do we live in a country, one of the biggest gas exporters in the world, and we're getting more tax from beer than PRT? Maybe it's one for the minister. This is a political decision.
The PRRT is called a tax, but it's really a supply charge, a royalty for using the gas. Before the war broke out, Australian exporters were set to take in $53 billion from exporting gas this year. It'll be far higher now. Why is the royalty collected through the PRRT so much lower, only $1.5 billion?
So there's a few things here. The first one is that the PRRT is one of other taxes that the gas industry pay. So last year, for example, the gas industry paid about $22 billion in taxes, which is about half of our education, the federal education budget.
This is ordinary income tax, ordinary company tax.
Through income tax mostly. It does pay tax, but the reason the PRRT is so low is because of the way PRRT is designed. And so the way to think about it is it says, look, we understand that an investor, when they make an investment, need to get their cost back, right, before we start charging super profit taxes on them. It makes more sense, let them get their investment back. But then after they've got their investment back, then we're going to take a lot. And for many of these projects, they still haven't made their cost back. And that's only going to actually, therefore, see the PRRT and the higher taxes kick in later this decade once they've paid back the original investment.
It takes a decade or two to return to profit for the purpose of the tax, the way profit is defined in the tax. It takes that long, and after that, the return should be, you know, if we live that long, the return should be quite good.
That's right. So on average, it's about 10 to 15 years. And then after that, you have almost an effective tax rate of 70%, which comes to the government. Now, the issue we face is we're not there yet. And of course, there's, you know, some demand to say some more tax now. And that's really what this debate is all about, is we don't want to be necessarily waiting a few more years, particularly if there's a budget hole at the moment. And is there a way to bring some of this tax forward or add an additional tax to get essentially earlier revenue?
Are there also accounting issues, Ben? You might go to the movies, I do sometimes, and almost no movie makes a profit for the purposes of sharing profits with actors who enter into a profit-sharing agreement. And this is a profit-sharing agreement with gas. There are all sorts of decisions that can be made which reduce apparent profits. Is there some of that here?
Yeah, there is, Peter. And this is argued, you know, not just by sort of activist groups who want to see the gas industry taxed into retreat, but budget experts over decades like Chris Richardson. And what they focus on is the historical uplift rate for the project expenses, I think, was the bond rate plus 15% until a few years ago, and then it was reduced to the bond rate plus 5%. And that's still about 9.25%, that the expenses compound over the years and are still very large.
So you can have a big expense, but it sort of grows over time.
Exactly. And even though the uplift rate has now been reduced, the historical uplift at bond rate plus 15%, which is, you know, pushing 20%, has created a body of carry forward losses for the purposes of PRRT that mitigate against the tax rising in line with the reported profits.
So the UK government has introduced what it calls a windfall profits tax. It did it when Russia invaded Ukraine. An extra 25% of profit. It's now more than that. It's now an extra third of profit. That wouldn't work here, I guess, if the companies aren't making accounting profits. David Pocock, who we just heard, wants something different. A 25% tax on all export revenue. It'd be paid as a charge for using the gas, whether or not the exporter was making a profit or making an accounting profit. He says it would raise $17 billion per year. The Greens, One Nation, support it. There's a Senate inquiry at the moment. Would that be better than what we have?
Well, look, there's different opinions on this, and I'll give you my opinion. And I think the starting point is that Australia's gas belongs to Australians. It's our government's job to try and get as much tax as possible from our resource base. We can do whatever we want in terms of taxing. We just need to be clear-eyed about the trade-offs, right? And the issue I think we have with some of the proposals, for example, from the Australia Institute and Senator Pocock, is we cannot tax an industry which no longer exists. So what they're proposing, if it existed 15 years ago, we would not have the LNG industry we have today.
They wouldn't have invested under that of 25% of all revenue.
With a 25% tax on revenue. There's already been changes to the BRT a few years ago. There were assurances made to the industry that there would not be more changes for another decade. When the government keeps changing the rules and breaking its word, it impacts the investment environment, not just for gas, but across the board.
How do you see this playing out, Ben?
Well, I think, firstly, to Saul's point, the proposal for a 25% tax on revenue, it works like a tariff in reverse. So, you know, that was considered a very bad thing in 2014. It could have the effect of reducing prices domestically, which Australian users would welcome. If you overdo that and reduce them too far, then you're acting against climate policies such as the safeguard mechanism that are trying to encourage local industry to use less gas.
That's the other side of it. So you're saying that by taxing exports, we're supporting domestic industry, a bit like a tariff. And yet, the use of gas, the use of any fossil fuel is another arm of government doesn't actually want to encourage that.
Well, precisely. But I think there is going to be some foreshadowing of an examination of taxation.
Sol, I'm wondering whether the best thing to do might be to sit tight. I say that because eventually this is going to come good. Eventually we're going to get a very large take of what are likely to be large and ongoing profits. Might it be best, I'm talking about tax here, to stick with what we've got and simply wait?
The LNG projects we have, we must remember, are due to last for decades and decades. They're still relatively young. They're only 10 to 15 years old. If we're willing to just be a little bit more patient and allow the tax system to work as it was designed to, we are going to see a huge uplift in taxes being paid. And I think we'll get the windfall that everyone's expecting. It's just that we're still in the period now where the projects are paying themselves back plus that base level of return. We've done the hard bit. We've waded through most of that period. We've only got a little bit to go. I understand why, particularly when you've got a cost of living crisis, et cetera, there's pressure to make some changes. But a little bit of patience here, I think, will pay off. We will get a much higher tax take and we won't have had to change the rules on our trading partners, our investment environments. And so we can have our cake and eat it too.
Ben, I'm thinking of that election ad in the 1980s. No one got anywhere changing horses in midstream. Do you think the public could actually cope with that sort of idea, with continuing to wait, continuing for a while longer to get low returns for the gas, knowing that it'll come good?
Look, I'm sure that's the inclination of Anthony Albanese. I'm not sure that patience and pragmatism are strong suits in the community at large. And so I think the government is going to feel under pressure. And in fact, the sort of core set of ministers are going to feel under pressure from others in the cabinet and the caucus to do something to increase the LNG revenue. And, you know, as I mentioned before, the industry has a bit of a credibility problem. So I feel like I understand the argument, but I feel the community expectations are pretty strong here. And there's some polling from reputable polling organisations that's been cited with very high super majorities in favour of increasing the tax take from the gas industry. Saul is correct to say that the geopolitical, the diplomacy with our LNG customers who are also liquid fuel suppliers is also extremely tricky. So it's going to be interesting to see how the government, you know, manages that, comes to some sort of approach that tries to keep everyone happy by budget day.
Before we go, Saul and Ben, as is traditional on this program, is there anything else? I think we know one thing to look out for in the days and weeks ahead. Saul?
One thing I think it's always important to bear in mind is, notwithstanding the kind of challenges and some of the hopes and expectations not being fully realised, our gas sector does, you know, fund half of our education budget. It is one of our key and perhaps only source of leverage right now to make sure we actually keep fuel in our economy. And I think it's just very important for us to make sure that we continue to have those benefits and don't, in an attempt to try and take even more, end up destroying the benefits that we are currently enjoying.
Ben?
Look, I'm looking for the flip side of this debate about gas reservation and especially gas taxation. In the lead up to the budget, the flip side of that is that there are current budget incentives for measures to reduce fossil fuel demand, incentives for home electrification, solar panels, batteries, electric vehicles, albeit in a very inefficient way. And there are other things that aren't subject to that, or at least don't benefit from those sorts of incentives, like electric trucks. And so the government has got this balancing act where it must be thinking, if it can raise more money from the gas industry, that it could help pay for some of these measures that would ultimately reduce liquid fuel demand and gas demand.
The budget is imminent. Ben Potter, contributing editor with The Energy, Saul Kavanagh, energy analyst with MST Financial. Thank you both so much for outlining a terribly involved and not terribly satisfactory story in some ways. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure as always.
Great to be here again.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays and now Saturday morning. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. We've had quite a few emails about last week's show on our dependence on petrol and diesel and the health effects of that. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.